You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the SmartCast Microlearning podcast series on ulcerative colitis, hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Kia Jones, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast. This is the third of five podcasts in the series titled Treatment Selection in Ulcerative Colitis, Optimizing Outcomes Through Patient-Centered Decision-Making. Today's podcast will focus on new and emerging therapies for ulcerative colitis, or UC. Joining me today is Dr. Bruce Sands, Dr. Burl B. Crohn Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and System Chief in the Division of Gastroenterology at Mount Sinai Health System in New York, New York. Welcome, Dr. Sands. It's so good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Kia. It's really great to be here with you.
Well, there has been a lot of advancements in the UC space over the last few years. Just last week, mirikizumab received FDA approval for moderate to severe UC, making it the first P19 IL-23 approved for UC. So definitely a lot happening. Dr. Sands, can you just start us off by describing the current FDA-approved treatment landscape for UC, particularly the more recent additions?
Sure. Yeah, it's become a kind of a complicated landscape as we've added more and more drugs with varying mechanisms of action. I think we can start historically with what we now call conventional therapies. These are things that have been used for really decades, things like 5-aminosalicylates, which are great for mild to moderate ulcerative colitis, not all that effective for moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, and ultimately a lot of patients fail them. Of course, corticosteroids were game-changing in the 1950s when patients with UC were literally dying from the condition. These were very valuable, but we know about all the pitfalls of using corticosteroids and their risks and safety issues. Then we had immune modulators of kind of the classic sort, which included thiopurines like azathioprine and mercaptopurine. And those do have a place as steroid-sparing agents, but they also have their safety issues, lymphoma, skin cancer, a variety of other things. So it really was 1998 when we saw the approval of infliximab for Crohn's disease, and much later, a number of years later in 2006, we saw its approval as the first biologic treatment for ulcerative colitis, and that was also a game changer. Highly effective for patients who didn't respond to other things, but also had its own safety issues. Number one, immunogenicity. Secondly, also risk of infections, sometimes serious infections, lymphoma, need to screen for TB and hepatitis B, all the things that we know about this class of agents. We later saw adalimumab. That was an incremental advance, another anti-TNF, but given subcutaneously, so a little bit more convenient. We saw golimumab, a second subcutaneous delivered anti-TNF. And then more recently than that, in around 2004, we saw the advent of vedolizumab, which was a whole new class of biologic agent, an anti-alpha-4 beta-7 integrin antibody. Phenomenal safety, very good efficacy, and really a nice addition to the armamentarium. After that, we saw the approval of the first small molecule in a long time, and that was tofacitinib. And tofacitinib is a JAK1 and 2 and 3 antagonist, and it's an orally given small molecule. It's not really selective for JAK1, 2, or 3. It's slightly selective for 1 and 3, but really is broadly JAK suppressing, and that's effective. But really, because of black box warnings, it's used later in the armamentarium after failure of anti-TNFs. We had the approval of ustekinumab, the first anti-IL-12 and anti-IL-23 antibody. It's directed against P40. And that was another advance. And then finally, we have the anti-integrin antibody, I mentioned those already, but really the S1P receptor modulators. Ozanimod was the first one of these, most recently etrasimod, and these are additional oral agents. And finally, We have our first anti-P19 antibody, which will block only IL-12, and that's mirikizumab, and that's now approved as well. So we've seen all these agents come along, and it really has become a little bit confusing, I think, for providers to keep all of them straight and know what their advantages and disadvantages, safety issues and efficacy, how to organize these things in the care of patients.
Sounds like there is a lot going on. Thank you so much for that wonderful summary. Now, with that, and you've kind of already touched on it, there being a need for an issue with clinicians being able to keep up with everything that's going on. Would you agree that one of the issues physicians face is the lack of good predictors of patient response to one therapy versus another? And if so, can you talk about head-to-head trials and, the need for more in the UC space?
Yes, it is definitely true that it's not for lack of trying to identify good predictors of response to specific classes of medications. Many people have proposed different clinical and laboratory factors that might predict response to one mechanism of action or another, but none of these end up being so accurate that they're clinically useful. And so, unfortunately, therefore, we've come to rely on just kind of looking at the treatment history, because we do have some data that helps to describe the prior treatment history and then the likelihood of response to the next agent in the sequence. By and large, we know in a broad sense that the more agents that you failed, the more likely you are to fail your next attempted agent. That's broadly true. But ideally, we're going to learn about which drug is better through head-to-head trials. That at least gives us kind of an even playing ground. It's the most rigorous way of assessing efficacy of one drug versus another. I suppose, we do have real-world evidence as well that is helpful. These are clinical effectiveness studies that try to adjust away potential confounders, but these aren't as rigorous because it doesn't permit for randomization. So there is some selection bias of patients. And then I guess finally, we have network meta-analysis that is also taking clinical trial data. And whereas it'll never be possible in a randomized controlled trial to have head to head to head to head to head of five different mechanisms of action, really we use network meta-analysis to control for differences in populations in the studies and the placebo response rates and try to adjust that away and tell us which is most effective. So I do think that head-to-head trials, though, are the most rigorous level of evidence that we can have.
Right. No, that's a very good point. Meta-analysis, in the absence of, being able to compare multiple drugs, head to head, those are definitely helpful. And especially in UC where there are multiple treatment options available, it's critical to have those studies so that we can, optimize care. So we've discussed the existing treatment landscape and some of the limitations associated with the agents currently available. Can you talk about some of the emerging UC therapies in the pipeline and what new options they may offer for individuals with UC?
Sure. Yeah, I think we can talk about things that are still in the pipeline and things that are still just so recent that we're still all learning about them. And I guess I would still put in that class the S1P modulators. These are not as familiar to gastroenterologists yet. The first one of these was ozanimod. More recently, very recently, was the addition of etrasimod. These work through modulating sphingosine 1 phosphate, which is important for guiding lymphocytes out of lymph nodes. And the long story short of the mechanism of action is essentially you're trapping living lymphocytes in the lymph nodes and keeping them out of circulation, and therefore they're not getting to the tissue of the colon or the small bowel and not really participating in inflammation. This class has been used for a long time in multiple sclerosis, but now we have two agents approved in ulcerative colitis. And what we know is that these are reasonably effective agents. They have convenience of oral dosing, but they're really best used as a first-line therapy for moderate to severely active ulcerative colitis patients. We know that after failure of more than one advanced therapy, typically an anti-TNF, the efficacy for induction drops dramatically. And therefore, if you have a very heavily pretreated patient with lots of prior treatment experience, this is not the best choice, but if you do choose it, you better be prepared to give the drug a relatively long period of time, 16 weeks or even 6 months, before you might decide that it isn't working. There are also some safety limitations there. We don't know about the safety of this class in women who wish to become pregnant, so we would avoid that. There's early bradycardia, although that tachyphylaxis very quickly. So we see different approaches to this. With ozanimod, they have dose titration. With etrasimod, they don't, but the rates of symptomatic bradycardia are quite low. There's the potential for macular edema in patients who are predisposed to that. If they have diabetes, for example, or a history of uveitis. And there is some increased risk of herpes zoster. Interestingly, not especially an increased risk of other kinds of serious or opportunistic infections, which is a little bit counterintuitive based on the MOA. The second more recent thing is a JAK1 selective inhibitor, which is upadacitinib. So it's a little bit different from tofacitinib, which is a pan-JAK inhibitor, as I said. That seems to be a highly effective agent, but as we know with this class of agents, there may be risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, thrombosis, cancer, and even mortality. That's contained in a black box warning, and so we're really only able to use this after failure of an anti-TNF. And then very recently, we have the approval of mirikizumab, and that is an IL-23 antibody, anti-IL-23. And that is effective in both patients who are bio-failed and bio-naive, although especially beneficial in the maintenance in the bio-failed patients. Also, this class has excellent safety. There might be increased risk of nasopharyngitis or injection site reactions, but again, we don't see signal for cancer or serious or opportunistic infection. And then we get to at least one thing that is still in the pipeline, but very promising, and that's anti-TL1A antibody. This is in the TNF superfamily, but it is not tumor necrosis factor. And this has been shown in a phase 1B study and a 2A study for one agent that was previously with one sponsor and then with another. And then more recently, we have a second such agent directed at this target from a second sponsor. Basically, all of these studies are positive. The efficacy looks similar to upadacitinib, which I told you may be the most effective agent we have, but with the side effect profile that I described. However, the side effect profile of anti-TL1A antibodies seems to be much more favorable so far. We're not seeing serious or opportunistic infection or a cancer signal. These are the medications that are either just out the pipeline or about to be soon, and they're going to provide many new options in the years to come. They'll add new options for us down the road.
Right, right. No, thank you so much for that overview. Definitely very interesting and exciting things on the horizon for UC, and definitely a reason to be optimistic about both the near and long-term future in managing UC. Can we now talk a little about areas of unmet need and just the importance of personalized medicine?
Right. Well, personalized medicine is the idea that we can select the winner for an individual patient, presumably through some biomarker that predicts response to one mechanism of action or another. And I think all of us would like to see this. There was a suggestion of a potential predictive biomarker in the anti-TL1A antibodies. We'll have to see if that pans out. But really, this speaks to the bigger need, which is that even though we have all these different mechanisms of action now, when each of them are given as a monotherapy, individual therapy to one patient, one drug at a time, we see real limitations in efficacy. And for all of them, over the course of a year, we barely see half the patients in remission at the end of a year. and we have a problem of loss of response. So there's a thinking that not only can personalized medicine help us pick the winner for an individual patient and overcome that barrier, but also potentially combining therapies might be a way in the future to synergize the efficacy of these different mechanisms of action. And in fact, we do have an example of that in ulcerative colitis in the VEGA study, which was published this past year, which showed the combination of golimumab, an anti-TNF, with guselkumab, an anti-IL-23 antibody, was superior to either of those drugs alone in patients with moderate to severely active UC. This was an early phase study, so we'll see if it's substantiated in the future, but it gives you promise that not only personalized medicine, but combination therapies might be the way forward in the future.
Absolutely. All excellent points. As I'm sure our listeners will agree, this has truly been an insightful and interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your expertise with us today.
My pleasure, Kia. It's been fun speaking with you.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to also give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity.